Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. My name is Marty Bennett, and I'm your host for this week's edition. We'll be covering three topics today that have come off across the wires in the last week or so in our news feeds, and would like to share our opinions on how some of these key issues can be leveraged on your own campuses to potentially lead to future improvements in how you do what you do in international education. Very happy to be with you today and talking about these issues. It's a really, as winter is here, winter is coming, wherever you are in the U.S. or around the world, perhaps you're dealing with that now. We're here in the Midwest, we're experiencing a nice, our first big cold spell of the year. Looking forward to having some snow finally. We'll see how that goes. But wanted to share with each of you today my reactions to three stories that have popped up, one of which I had the pleasure of writing for Hot Courses Group as part of my series for them, designed for higher ed audiences in the United States. And it's entitled Lessons Learned. Not sure if you've seen this post yet, but came out last Thursday. It's the first of a three-part series I'm doing on lessons learned. And what the focus of this article is on is really how institutions react when their worlds get turned upside down, particularly the worlds of their prospective students and their current students. This first article, Lessons Learned, addressed how U.S. universities respond when international students' worlds turns upside down. And part one is focusing on 9/11. And I've had the pleasure, obviously, of being in the industry for well over 25 years now. And 9/11 was a traumatic time for everyone involved, whether you were connected to people in New York or D.C. or Pennsylvania that that died that day, or were injured, or involved in the search and rescue of people who were trapped. Just a traumatic day. Those who have gone on to serve in the military and other ways, serving their country after those attacks of 9/11. But in international education, our industry was rocked, plain and simple, on that day. And the after effects were felt for years to come. Some would even say that they're still being felt today in some respects. But what the approach I took with this article was looking at folks who were on the institutional side during 9/11 and the immediate aftermath, and looking at how they approached those very trying times for their offices, for their industry, and for their students, most importantly. The reactions from colleagues that I've known for and have enormous amounts of respect for, from Bill Elliott, who was at the time at Lakeland College in Mattoon, Illinois, to Ted McCown at Kent State, who's still there today, to Joyce Lance at, she's currently at Notre Dame, was then at St. Mary's College, to Brian Gross, currently at Western New England University, who was at Bridgeport shortly after 9/11. They all shared some very interesting perspectives on what their institutions did during that time, and I encourage everybody to read that article, and I've posted the link to it in the comments section on our Facebook page, but you can also get to that copy of that article on my smieconsulting.org site under the blog page. All of my blogs are listed, blog posts are listed there as well. Myself, I was at an international school in England, working with my wife at American International Schools in Cobham, England. We were at that school 9/11, the day the attacks happened. It was right at the end of the school day. I remember 2:33 o'clock when things started unraveling on all the news media. But so I didn't have the fortune at that point of being on a U.S. college campus, but I certainly remember the feeling for all the families on our campus who have children from age 3 to 18 at our school at that time. The impact it had on those that were trying to get in touch with loved ones for the next few days back in the United States, or those they knew were traveling that day in the U.S., particularly those who had friends and family in New York and D.C. So there's just a lot of memories that come flowing back with that, and the colleagues that shared their feedback on this story, on what where they were post 9/11 with their institutions was particularly eye-opening. But one comment set of comments I do want to direct student attention to, your attention to, as you think about post 9/11 reactions, and how eventually in part 2 and 3 we'll look at some of the lessons learned from this experience, but also the other half of what this lessons learned series is about is responding to the elections of 2016. And how there are some stark similarities and obvious differences, but some stark similarities in terms of what the impact has been on U.S. international education efforts. So, but one of the articles folks that I focused on was Karen Bauer. For those who know her, she's currently Education USA REAC for portions of the Middle East and now Central Asia. She used to have the entire Middle East, but that has just parts of that now. But she has a deep connection with Saudi Arabia. She had lived there for a number of years, was the country coordinator in Saudi Arabia for Education USA for a number of years. Had taught at a girls' school in Jeddah prior to 9/11, and actually had, as she revealed in an interview with me, revealed that she had actually taught Bin Laden's daughters at that school before obviously everything blew up. Literally. And that's her experience in terms of the how international ed professionals responded to the Arab students that they had on campus, the Muslim students they had on campus, spoke volumes with about the U.S.'s commitment to, on the college and university campuses, commitment to international education. And I really, really have to hand it to anyone working in the field. I had the pleasure of coming back to the U.S. shortly after 9/11 and began work at St. Mary's College in Indiana, and had some very interesting stories and learned a lot about the institution's commitment to international education at the time. There was, at that time, a full tuition scholarship, full room and board scholarship the institution had that we committed after 9/11, we committed to finding a suitable candidate, and we ended up selecting a young woman who had been very active in Afghanistan, an Afghani woman who went on to study at St. Mary's College on a full scholarship, and was for a small school like St. Mary's, that was a big commitment to step up and make that investment in her and her future. So. If you read through the article, you'll see a lot of what institutions were, how they responded post 9/11, had to do with their current students and making sure that they were okay, that they were protected and felt welcomed at that time. Even then, when there were reports around the country of students being assaulted and threatened and go back to your country type of rhetoric, and sounds eerily similar to what's happened today, but for very different reasons. And I think that the warm, open arms that campuses embraced their students with, their current students with, made how they responded made a huge difference in how that how those institutions maintained what they had and then eventually grew their populations internationally. And that there's some great examples in the article I reference from folks, particularly Kent State and Bridgeport, where they really committed to actually not cutting back, but actually advancing their efforts in a number of countries that have reaped benefits to this day for them. And there's a great lesson to be learned here through, I think, these responses. And we'll talk more about that in the second part of this article that'll come out later this month. But I think you see an industry, international education, that was under incredible pressures post 9/11. And what came out of that, I think, were some really dramatic shifts in how institutions related to international education, and not just institutions on college and university campuses, but more broadly, looking at how states and regions collaborated to raise their profiles internationally with students, particularly in the Middle East. And we'll talk more about that in after the next month's edition comes out. But some hopefully a good food for thought for those of you in the, that perhaps weren't in the field back in 2001 and shortly after. But it certainly will give, there'll be some themes in there that you'll see resonating with what's happening today in the international ed circles in the United States. So we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. Our second topic, we'll hop across the pond to the UK. And there was a fresh report coming out of Times Higher Ed this past week that revealed that the Russell Group of institutions, and these are the kind of the top level research prominent institutions in the UK, they're reporting now the big fear in the UK is they're coming up on the deadline for a Brexit deal at the end of March, in just a couple months' time. And they're worried about, particularly on the institutional level, they're worried about the impact a no-deal Brexit could mean for their institutions. The Russell Group, obviously, a very well-established, the best in many people's eyes, the best universities in the UK, at least reputationally, are now suffering as a result of fears of what Brexit might mean without any deals in place that would protect EU students that might be coming to Britain for studies. This article was focused particularly on the postgraduate numbers, and the link has been posted to that Times Higher Ed story on the comments section on the Facebook page. So feel free to give that a look and see some of the more of the details of it. But they're saying that they've dropped 5% in a year in terms of their postgraduate courses for master's degrees and such of EU students. EU students are going to be much less, according to this article, are given a no-deal scenario, are going to be much less likely to enroll in UK universities, which threatens, in the Russell Group's eyes, the well-being of their research and funding sources that they have, programs that they run, research that they do is impacted by not having these EU students on their campuses. So this may be isolated to the Russell Group, but it may also be a sign of future things to come for other sectors of British higher ed that might be dependent on EU markets for the lion's share of their students. What's their fee structure going to be, visa regulations, how are those going to be changing for EU students come the end of March? That's not yet determined, and that's one of the great fears, is if these students get placed into non-EU visa categories, what's that going to mean for their ability to enter the UK, to get visas, and then the funding question of what are the fees going to be for these students? Those are significant hurdles for these EU students that British universities are hoping to minimize as much as possible. But there's really no way yet to see how that's going to impact what's going on in the UK, because there's no deal. It's really a time in British higher ed that's very uncertain, and they are dealing with their own challenges, not only on the EU situation post-Brexit, but also with other visa regulations that have been put in place in the last few years. And we've talked about that in the past on episodes past, about how that's impacting recruitment efforts in certain countries. There's even an article out today that I'll probably touch on next week about where British institutions are going to be focusing more of their efforts, maybe back to China more heavily than they already are, which is, again, for many countries around the world that are destinations for international students, Chinese students are right up there, particularly in the English-speaking world. In Australia, the U.S., Chinese students already make up over a third, and those proportions in the U.K. are probably very similar. I haven't seen those for this past year, but know that they're fairly high. But you can count on China, if some of these EU markets dry up, China, India perhaps be ones that the British universities will be investing more heavily in years to come. So we'll see where that goes. So interesting times on both sides of the Atlantic for international educators. We have our challenges here, no doubt, but in the UK, a lot of uncertainty there as well with what's going to happen with if there is going to be a Brexit deal. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and months. So stay tuned for more on that story. The final article I push out to you today is one that you know, for those who've known me for a number of years, will know that social media is near and dear to my heart in terms of promoting an institution through its stories and through its students and faculty. That's something that I value very highly. I think it's an integral part of any communication plan that institutions have, any recruitment strategies that universities and colleges have for international students. You need to be there. You need to live where your audiences live, and that's something I've talked about for many years, going back to my days at Education USA and even before that at Ball State University. But when it comes to social media, one of the questions you often hear or fears that you hear is, well, do we let our students get involved in this and allow them to post? And how about our faculty and our staff? Do we engage them and have them as part of our overall social media strategy? So it's fascinating. There's a lot of different models out there. And if you've received our newsletter, you've seen a story this week already, a great story out of the University of Florida, where they don't actually pay their social media interns. They try and create a fun environment for their students to actually want to do this for their institution, and they have a policy. They don't pay their social media interns, but they do rely on them to produce content, student-generated content for their various sites. So the story I'm posting now is coming out of Higher Ed Live. Higher Ed Live is one that if you follow international admissions or admission circles in the United States, certainly you know about Higher Ed Live. It's a great resource. They have special guests, industry experts coming on to share their feedback on how institutions should be responding to different challenges in the industry. They've just had an article this past week on using social media on behalf of universities, and they look at actually a university in Norway, Oslo Metropolitan University, and a couple of folks, their social media manager and head of alumni relations, co-authored the article. And they basically share their experiences on what it took for them to prepare their staff, prepare students that they wanted to have engaged in social media on behalf of the university. And part of it is leveraging students and faculty that were already interested in posting about their institution and gathering them together and instructing them, equipping them with skills that they needed in terms of knowledge base on, for particularly the staff, what social media skills do they need to know? Things like, how do I upload a profile picture? How do I retweet? How should I use LinkedIn to engage alumni? How do I track activity on my social accounts related to the article I've linked to? So the institution really, for the staff, took it at a 101 for social media training for those that wanted to get involved, and made it available as a training course for their faculty and staff who wanted to participate. And on the student side, obviously there's a lot more enthusiasm and familiarity with students. Students frankly they like to go their own way and want to create their own content. Not necessarily wanting to share the pre-made content that the university was running on. So what the students do is they made it very personal. And that's one of the beauties of social media, is it can be as personal as you want it. Students took it to to the extent that they do. They shared vignettes of their own life as a life of a student. They created their own content. They really were pretty much able to do things unfettered from their own social media accounts. The university was involved in, has been very much involved in the Oslo Pride parade, and they shared their experiences around that and how that led to a real explosion in student engagement with regard to university posts and tagging themselves in that. So I think that's really impressive to see for a university to really invest in their staff and their students around these kind of issues to elevate the discussion and to really help provide their student body and prospective student audiences a real reflection of what the university is committed to. So kudos to the folks at Oslo Metropolitan for making that effort and investment in their own students. As I mentioned, there were a couple of other stories I profiled in our SMIE Consulting newsletter. For those of you who aren't subscribed to the newsletter, it's called All the SMIE News. That's Social Media and International Education News, fit to share. It's published every Monday around 9 o'clock Eastern. And I'm posting the link to this week's edition, so you can see some of those other social media stories that I was referencing earlier, particularly the one at the University of Florida. But there's also another story about social media from perspective of universities and how they're engaging particularly group chats in their social media efforts. So very, very much worthwhile checking out if you haven't already. And I'm also gonna throw in a plug for our website, smieconsulting.org. If you haven't already gotten onto that site, some great free resources there for institutions that are looking to enhance or refine their international recruitment strategies. A lot of what I do for institutions is everything working with partners in the UK on social media audits, website audits, refining overall strategy related to what countries you're targeting for your recruitment efforts, to particular strategies on the digital front, to involving current students, future students, parents, alumni in your recruitment efforts. So I talk a lot about those. Part of the services that you'll see on the site are reflected there. But it's also an opportunity to dive into some resources that I've developed over the years through my blog, through this newsletter, the podcasts, and the video chats that you're seeing here. We do also podcast this midweek roundup on all your favorite podcast services, from iTunes to Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, and at least one or two others. So I invite you to check that out and subscribe. So in case you don't want to watch me, which you certainly can do, either the archive of these on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting or on our YouTube channel. There's a playlist for these videos of the half hour long midweek roundup. So I encourage you to check out those resources, subscribe to the newsletter on our website. The links are provided on the Facebook page, but at smieconsulting.org, you'll be able to wrap yourself around all of these particular resources we're discussing today. So I want to say thank you again to all of you for joining in and watching the recordings or listening on the podcast. Happy to have the conversations with you and look forward to further conversations down the road. Have a wonderful day. Cheers.